I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances. Whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death, we all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What? Well, you know, the important thing about growing older and getting wiser is learning when you shouldn't make a what's Xing my Y's joke about a series of profoundly horrific crimes against humanity. And
yeah.
I've grown as a person. So
good job.
We're just going to go into the episode and not think at all about what it is I was going to say before I stopped myself and narrowly avoided cancellation. This is Behind the Bastards, a podcast about the worst people in all of history, of whom I would have been one had I completed the sentence that this introduction was meant to be initially, as it was originally planned. But I didn't, so you motherfuckers can't cancel me. That's right. I'm going to go...
Unfortunately, this also means that you will never be installed as leader of a country by the CIA.
Don't say never. Don't say never. You never, like, what do you, I mean, anybody, look, a man can dream. Christopher, we're talking more about Manchuria today. We just went through a lot of war crimes. Where are we?
Is it time? Is it time for The Reckoning, as you titled
yeah.
this?
It is, yeah. Tishy 2, The Reckoning.
Fuck yeah. Spicy. Let's go.
Yeah. So we are back in Japan. We are back in 1945 and we are back in, well, I guess we are back in the US occupation. And okay, now I think a pretty natural reaction to seeing the words a US military occupation is to assume that it's going to go badly. And it is, but it actually didn't start out that way. And it didn't start out that way because the first phase of the sort of Japanese occupation by the U.S. is run by a bunch of New Dealers. And these guys looked at Japan and were like, okay, so what if instead of fascism, we did the New Deal? And so they do a bunch of stuff that's like really leftist. Like for example, the big one that you could never do in the U.S., they do this huge land reform package where they force all the landlords who own a certain amount of land to like sell it to their tenants. And, you know, it's, there's like 2 years, you know, 1945, 1947, where, you know, the U.S. like is actually kind of trying to make Japan like better and more democratic and less shit. But all of that comes to an end in 1947, basically as a result of the Cold War. And this is called the reverse course. And it signifies basically when American business interests like take control of Japan. And, you know, like in 1950, they do this thing called the Red Purge, where they like they use mass firing of like suspected communists and just mm-hmm. like, yeah. And anyone who's sort of like vaguely associated with the left just like get fired from their jobs, both in the government and the private sector. This is coordinated. Like,
and if I'm not mistaken, this is kind of around the time when there's also a lot of protests against the American occupiers because a bunch of GIs are raping ladies.
Yeah.
Which is like another major thing that drives a lot of like the early protests post-war in Japan.
Yeah. They're also just like shooting people, and we'll get mm-hmm. more into soldiers just randomly murdering people.
Excellent. But,
you know, I guess actually speaking of soldiers randomly murdering people. So one of the reasons why fascism is never really sort of like crushed in Japan is that the head of G2, which is the Army's Intelligence Section, is also a fascist. And, you know,
no way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I said, like, this is not me calling Charles A. Willoughby a fascist, though. Like, this guy is going to go on to become like Franco's promoter in Europe. Like, MacArthur calls him a fascist.
Wow. MacArthur, yeah, like, the guy who suggested nuking cities in China to win the Korean War. If that dude calls you a fascist,
yeah,
you're probably pretty fucking fashy.
You know, and this is a big issue because Willoughby's job, like the actual job he is there to do is to like just completely obliterate the rest of the Japanese fascist organizations and Japanese fascist societies. And what he does instead is he used the G2's counterintelligence corps to do union busting and staging false flag attacks and blaming them on the Socialist Party. And he does one other thing that's both incredibly important to this story and important to Japanese history. He decides he wants to start negotiating with the Yakuza in order to sort of like use them as a weapon against the left. And in order to this, yeah, it's great. You can see where this is going. He goes.
I mean, versions
to,
of this happen in Italy with the mafia too, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Italian mafia is interesting because every once in a while they like will back a leftist. Like that's like mm-hmm. how the sort of weird Red Brigade stuff happened. But like,
right.
The Yakuza, they're just fascist. Like, there's no.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah,
for them.
Yeah, it's great, and yeah, and so Willoughby goes to Tsugumo Prison, which is like this is the giant war criminal prison where the U.S. is holding all the war criminals, and he meets with Kishi's cellmate. Now, Kishi's cellmate is a guy named Kodama Yoshio, who's like a giant Yakuza boss. He's involved in the drug trade. He was also arrested for his part in the incredibly named League of Blood incident in 1932. Which is this giant, like, fascist plot to just assassinate a bunch of business owners and liberal politicians. And, you know, so he gets arrested for, this is 1932, and he gets arrested, and then he gets released. And then, you know, because, again, the Japanese Empire is just a giant cartel with, like, a state attached to it. He spends the entire war as Japan's, like, procurement guy, which means that he's running around, like, basically trading heroin for, like, tungsten, radium, guns, and, like, other stuff to fight the war. And so Willoughby meets with this guy because he also, you know, he still has a bunch of Yakuza connections, and he has like $175 million that he made from the war just like on him. And so Willoughby cuts a deal with Kodama that's like, okay, I'll get you out of war crimes jail if you become an American intelligence asset. And Kodama's like, this is just all wins. And so Kodama like immediately like basically reforms this like, I guess you call it like the United Front of like crime and fascism. It's like it's this group. It's this association of like 400 right wing like fascist and criminal organizations that Kodama just like runs. And, you know, he's going to spend the next 30 years basically just running Japanese politics from the shadows and being basically like the Yakuza politics guy. Now, how Kishi escaped the noose in 1948 is a subject of some debate. Like, so the U.S. doesn't charge him with the sex slavery crimes or like the forced labor crimes. What he's charged with is violating like crimes against the peace, which is like starting an offensive war. But like even if you just stick to that, like he is the guiltiest man in human history. Like he signed the Declaration of War against the U.S. Like
this is
the easiest conviction ever. Like,
yeah, that really also ought to, like, just as a rule, if you're like someone else who lives in that country and a guy is like, hey, I want to continue being influential. You know me. I'm the guy who helped declare war in the U.S. You would think that, like, everyone would be like, well, we shouldn't be listening to anything you say.
Yeah. You
that didn't go very well.
You would think. And, you know, I've seen some stories that talk about, like, some sort of like group of American businessmen interceded on his behalf. I don't know how reliable that is. The other explanation, and this is true regardless of exactly what happened to Kishi, is that like the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal just kind of gave up. like trying to actually prosecute people because it was too much work. And it was like the Cold War was happening and they just didn't care anymore. And so they do just like a bunch of absolutely half-assed proceedings. And, you know, they rush like Tojo to the gallows and a few people, the people they wanted to kill. And then everyone else just goes free. And so on Christmas Eve 1948, Nobusuke Kishi, the man who enslaved Manchuria and ran the fascist war machine, walked out of prison. And because his brother, future Prime Minister Sato Isaku, is the cabinet chief secretary, Kishi is immediately driven to the Prime Minister's house. He's immediately driven to Prime Minister's house where he trades his prison oranges for a business suit and utters the immortal words, quote, "Well, I guess we're all Democrats now."
Oh, God. Ew. Ew. Yeah. Ew. Gross. Yeah. Not good. Bad. Not cool or good. Ew.
And thus, Nobusuke Kishi, arch-fascist bureaucrat, entered the new world of electoral politics.
Oh, God. That's
You love
depressing.
To see it. Yeah, it's like if Wernher von Braun had run for Congress.
Yep.
As opposed to just running NASA.
Yeah. And, you know, okay, so initially he starts putting together basically like the old fascist base. So like he gets some small business owners. He gets some like old school 1931 like fascist terrorists. Yeah. He gets his friends at Nissan are like, yeah, we loved this Manchuria shit. Like we're giving him all of our money. And the other, you know... One of the other, like, very disturbing things about what happened after the war is that, so, you know, I talked to the last episode, Kishi founds this thing called the Ministry of Munitions, which is just, like, the super ministry that does all this planning stuff. And basically all of his old, like, fascist reform bureaucrat buddies who are in the Ministry of Munitions keep their jobs, and the ministry just turned into the Ministry of International Trade and Industry. And, you know, and MIDI is the core of Japanese post-war development. And it's, you know, it's all the old fascist shit that Kishi was doing before, except the difference is that it's now being used to sort of like it's being used to fuel the American war machine in Korea and Vietnam instead of fueling the Japanese war machine also in Korea and Vietnam. So, yeah, this is purging the fascists is going well. And when I say going well, I mean in 1952, the U.S. just like gave up any semblance of trying to get rid of fascism and just unpurged everyone they'd purged.
We pardoned a lot of them. We gave the others jobs.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and the interesting thing with Kishi, so the prime minister at the time is Yoshida Shigeru, who was like, this is not a good guy. Like he was also a fascist before the war. But he tells the Americans, do not unpurge this guy. Like, do not unpurge Kishi. And it's extremely funny because, you know, as I mentioned last episode, like, Yoshida is related to Kishi. Like, you remember that uncle that Kishi really liked who, like, raised him for a little bit?
Yeah.
So that guy's daughter, like, is Yoshida's wife. Like, they know each other. Like, Kishi knows this guy's family. And he's still just like, do not do this. Do not let this guy come back into politics. And the U.S. is just like... No, fuck it. Well, he's back. Kishi's back.
He'll be fine.
Yeah. And, you know, so Kishi.
You may not have heard of us. We're the United States.
Yeah.
We don't think things through.
Nope. Well, I mean, you know, I would say this works out great for the U.S.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Hooray. Yeah. It's great. And, you know, and Kishi runs this electoral federation thing in 1952, and it just gets like destroyed. Like, because 1952, everyone's like, we don't like this guy. And I mean, he has a lot of money. He has like hundreds of millions of yen. And so they get like whacked. And so Kishi starts like wheeling around the political scene going, okay, like, what can I latch on to? And like, he almost joins the right wing of the Socialist Party, which would have been the single weirdest pivot I've ever seen in my life. But his brother convinced him to join the ruling sort of center right liberal party instead. And, you know, like... This is Yoshida's party, and Yoshida, like, doesn't like Kishi, but the Liberal Party is also falling apart, so he's like, okay, we need Kishi's support. And so in 1953, Kishi joins the party and wins a seat in the Diet. Now, Yoshida's getting help from a lot of places in that election, because 1953 is the first post-war election after the American occupation. And if you know anything about elections that happen in fascist countries immediately after... The end of World War II, you know that Yoshida is being backed by the CIA.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And, yeah. If you know anything that happened about elections that happened in these countries after World War II, you know that they didn't.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because it's like, I think this story is weirder than like the Italian stories. Like, you know, and this, I mean, you know, I guess so the way this is funded is that at the beginning of the Korean War, Like, the U.S. needed a bunch of tungsten, and American intelligence basically was like, we need to keep the Socialist Party from literally ever taking power, like, at all costs. And so they talked to Kodama, who's that Yakuza guy from before the war, who Willoughby had, like, broken out of jail. And they get him to smuggle a bunch of tungsten that had been left over from Japan's World War II stockpiles to the U.S., and then they pay him $10 million, and the CIA throws in $2.8 million of their own, and that money is, like, that money is how the Liberal Party, like, wins 1953 elections.
Cool.
It's great.
I mean,
it's going to get worse.
That seems fine. I bet we did good stuff with all that tungsten.
Yeah, we absolutely bombed the shit out of Korea.
I bet it didn't get fired into multiple countries worth of civilian.
It's great.
Okay. Anyway, great.
So, you know, Kishi gets elected as part of the Liberal Party, but, you know, Kishi is a backstabbing son of a bitch. And he immediately turns on Yoshida and, like, starts denouncing him. Yoshida kicks him out of the party, but Kishi's able to get this, like, breakaway faction to join him, and he forms something called the Democratic Party. And through a lot of incredibly complicated electoral bullshit, like, they're able to oust Yoshida as prime minister. And then Kishi has this giant plan to, like, reunify the two wings of reunify the two wings of the right. There's, like, his wing is Democratic Party, and then there's the Liberal Party, and he has to reunify them. And the reason he wants to do this is because he wants to control it. But the reason it actually happens is that the Socialist Party had split in, like, 1948 or something. In 1955, they come back together. And that just, like, freaks all the conservatives out, and they're like, okay, fine. Like, we'll join this new party. And the new party they form is called the Liberal Democratic Party. Now, this is important. The reason I spent so much time talking about this is that the LDP is the single most important party in Japanese politics. In the 66 years since they were founded in 1955, the LDP has been out of power for six. They were in power for the other
Jesus
60.
Christ.
Yeah, this is like Japan is almost a one-party state. Yeah, it's unbelievable. And, you know, and this is Kishi's party. Like, he is the guy who single-handedly built this party. This party would not exist if Kishi had not gone into the Liberal Party, like, tore them apart and then force them to join his breakaway faction. And, you know, like, he's the reason why it exists. And this party, like, this is the party that's the basis of the entire modern Japanese political system.
Cool.
And yeah, it's great. Kishi, you know, he makes himself the general secretary of the party and wins, you know, in his first election, he wins an absolute majority in the Diet for the LDP. But, you know, instead of becoming prime minister himself, he spends his time sort of biting, like, sort of building up American support for him. Now, you know, we talked about the CDP, I mean, the CIA had been heavily involved with the Liberal Party, and they've been heavily involved with the Liberal Democratic Party, like, from the start. I mean, this is from a New York Times article. "We financed them," said Alfred C. Ulmer Jr., who ran the CIA's Far East operations from 1955 to 1958. "We depended on the LDP for information." He said the CIA had used the payments both to support the party and recruit informants from it from its earliest days. And so the CIA, like, they're working with the LDP on, like, a candidate-by-candidate basis. Like, the CIA has their own electoral guys, and the electoral guys will, like, go to a candidate and go, "We need you to win this seat," and they'll, like, personally hand them money. And so, you know, this is where you get the first of the Dulles brothers entering the sort of political arena.
Hell yeah.
And then I still let you before this. In 1955, you also get the second Dulles brother, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, who, mm-hmm. like, basically
My
just
boys.
Straight up, yeah, like, he just, like, straight up, 1955, is, like, the Liberal, like, he's, like, tells the Japanese, like, the Liberal Party will unify with the Democratic Party, and, like, if you don't, like, vague threat insert here. And so John Foster Dulles, directly responsible in many ways, both the Dulles brothers are responsible for Kishi, like, forming the most important political party in the history of Japan. And all of this ends with Kishi becoming prime minister in 1957. And he just immediately starts doing crime. So
what else are you going to do? For sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, this Kishi's like Kishi's an incredible money launderer from his time in Manchuria. Like, you know, and he devises a scheme to, like, make some money off of the reparations payments that Japan had to pay to, like, the countries that it invaded after the war. And so he basically what he does is he negotiates to have these reparations payments, like, paid in Japanese goods and services. And so he buys those Japanese goods and services with state money from his own corporate political allies. And then,
good. Okay.
Yeah, he turns. Yeah, it's great. It's great. He's using the reparations payment to, like, pay off his, like, fascist buddies. And then he does the exact same thing to, like, the Japanese foreign aid. like projects, it's also all just Kishi's like buddies paying themselves. And, you know, Kishi, he also like, he develops this system of like, so Kishi like constantly rotates through cabinets in the time that he's privileged, like constantly. And the reason he's doing this is because it's basically a way to buy off his political allies. So like, you know, you give an ally a cabinet minister and then they get to loot a bunch of money. And then once they've taken enough money, you put in the next person, you put in the next person, you put in the next person. And, you know, he's also just like, he's not only doing this with like sort of politicians and like businessmen, he's doing this with the Yakuza. So what if the you know, he makes like a sworn Yakuza guy, like his Ministry of Agriculture. And then there's the wonderfully named Bambuko Ono, who Kishi...
That is a
like,
cool name.
Yeah, it's amazing. Kishi makes this guy the Secretary General of the Liberal Democratic Party. And he stays in that position until Ono dies in 1965. And Ono is wonderful because he gives a speech to 2,000 Yakuza members in the 60s, where like he just straight up says like, yeah, I'm Yakuza, but I do it by being a politician instead of being a criminal. It's like, it rules. And so, and you know, the other thing that's happening is that Kishi's still, you know, Kishi's connected to sort of Kodama, and Kodama's like whole like Yakuza American intelligence network. And so when Lockheed Martin is trying to get the Japanese Defense Force to buy their like F-104 Starfighter over Northrop Grumman's F-11F, their guy in Japan, who just happens to be an old G2 intelligence guy, is like, I know a guy. And the guy that he knows is Kodama, who he pays like millions of dollars in bribes to. Is like, they give him like a $600,000 commission on every plane they sell to get this sold to the Japanese government. And so Kodama goes to his Yakuza connections in the government, which is, you know, his Yakuza buddy and newly mentioned LDP Secretary General Bamako Ono and his good friend Nobusuke Kishi. And Kishi buys the starfighter, and Lockheed just like keeps Kodama on retainer for like the next 30 years. And, you know, I want to give people a sense of like how embedded this like intelligence fascist Yakuza network is in the LDP, because it's not like this is a thing that's only Kishi and it goes away. Like in the 1970s, Kodama gets hired again by Lockheed to do exactly the same thing. And he pays out like several million dollars in bribes. Like he bribes the prime minister again. And this time he gets caught. And, you know, he took so much money from like the Americans and bribing people that like he managed to piss off both the far right and the far left. And so, you know, they start protesting his house. And on May 23rd, 1976, a fascist porn star named Misua Maneo, who'd been a huge Kodama fanboy, rents
boy,
a
that
plane.
Shouldn't exist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's going to get better. So he rents a plane. He like circles Kodama's house, like shouting pro-imperial slogans into a microphone. And then like he screams bonsai and flies the plane into his house. Like this is in 1976. Kodama's
that's
house is
kind of rad, to be honest. That's you know what? You got to give it up sometimes. That critical support. Very well, you know, cool. Undeniably though, rad move.
Kodama lives through this.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, but does
guy,
he really?
A guy kamikaze in his house in 1970s, like a fascist porn star kamikaze in his house, and he lived through it. It's just, yeah, that's I mean, that is basically the end of him in politics, but it's like, it's great. It's great.
That is a flex.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a profoundly fascist party with profoundly fascist people in it. And so back in 1957, Kishi's dealing with like his first real political scandal, which is that on January 30th, 1957, a U.S. soldier named Girard, like basically just for fun, shot an empty grenade cartridge out of a grenade launcher at a Japanese woman who was like collecting shell casings and military base sell for scrap, and she dies.
Oh God.
Yeah. And you know, and this pisses off everyone in Japan. And you know, I mean, especially it's revealed later, she's a mother of six, and everyone just loses their mind. And Eisen, and you know, and there's this huge fight over it. And Eisenhower wants to like try him in an American court. And Eisenhower like is literally forced to like try him in a Japanese court, because like if he tried to do it in an American court, like people would have literally like brick by brick dismantled every American military base in the islands. And so Kishi's main concern here is that this is going to like fuck up his political stuff. And so he develops this plan, and he's going to go to Eisenhower and make a bunch of demands about this U.S.-Japan security treaty. Mm-hmm. And this is like one of the other things that's been causing protests, is that this treaty is like signed in 1951 originally, and it's really weird. Like, it lets the U.S. like send troops into Japan to put down, quote, internal riots or disturbances, which is. Yeah, there's and the other like in terms of like a peace treaty, and the other thing is it lets the U.S. involve itself in civil wars, and like you know a bunch of Japanese commentators point out like there's like no precedent for this, like there's never been a peace treaty that like between two free nations that allows this. So you know, and you get these massive protests, like people like build giant wooden fortresses and man them for like 40 years in the middle of American artillery ranges. Like there's all of this stuff. And, you know, Eisenhower meets with Kishi and is like, and Kishi just goes like you have to revise this treaty. And Eisenhower's like, okay. And so Kishi like stakes basically his entire political career on revising this U.S.-Japan security treaty, which becomes known as Anpo. And, you know, like, it really looks like he's going to, like, pull this off. He's going to get treaty revisions. He's going to be incredibly popular. Until Kishi just, like, Kishi just got, like, that extra bit too fascist. And the extra bit too fascist was he tried to pass something called the Police Duties Execution Law.
Ooh, which that is like sound good. That
yeah, is, like,
it, that's that just already seems like we're on a bad start.
Yeah, like. Like this is a police law so fascist that like his other fascist hardliner buddies like in the LDP are like, we won't let you pass this because you'll get eaten alive. Yeah, it basically like what it does is it lets the Japanese it would have let the Japanese police do warrantless searches and seizures.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and you know, and everyone's like, okay, so this is just like this is pre-war fascism again. So you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think he thinks he can get away with this because he's done a bunch of other like fascist culture war mm-hmm. sort of stuff. Like he does this thing where he makes everyone take these like moral lessons, and like all the students take like moral lessons, and has these like evaluations of teachers because he thinks there's like they're too communist and wants fascist propaganda like taught instead. And you know, I want to make it clear there is no parallel. Between this and anything that is happening in the U.S. right now, go back to sleep. There's nothing here. Everything's going to be fine. It's like, yeah, no one in the U.S. is raging a bunch of political campaigns about what teachers are teaching in school because they think it's too leftist.
No, that has not happened. But you know what does happen in the U.S.?
Products and services?
That's right. That's God willing, the only thing that will ever happen in this country in the future going forward. Because when you get right down to it, what else do we need? But products, services, and of course, the blissful, gooey, moist, sticky,
what?
Cum-drenched
Robert,
product
fuck off.
Of products
Stop it.
And services.
Stop it.
What?
Stop
oh,
it.
Okay.
Stop it.
Well, let's just go to ads.
Gosh.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to Season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, starting May 6th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ah, we're back. Okay, Chris, please continue.
Yes, Chris, please continue.
Sophie's angry at me because she doesn't like it when I say cum drenched while leading into an ad.
Not at all. I don't think anybody enjoyed that. And if you did, please don't tell us.
I think our sponsors enjoy it, Sophie.
Oh, no.
All right.
I mean, it could be Nissan. We could be getting a sponsor for Nissan this episode.
That's fair. Yeah, it could be Nissan.
Absolutely inappropriate.
Nissan.
Mm-hmm.
So Kishi's gotten a bit too fascist. And he does this thing where, the way that like the norms of the Japanese political system worked was that like, you're supposed to, before you pass a bill, you're supposed to talk to the opposition about it. And then there's supposed to be a debate. And Kishi's just like, yeah, fuck that. Like, he's just like, snap introduces it without like, he takes a snap vote to extend the diet and just like snap forces everyone to try to vote on it. And this is like maximally bad politics by Kishi. Like, you know, I say this like the norms of democracy are like actually important to Japan, and they're important because this is a country that was a decade and a half ago literally fascist. And Kishi's trying to pass this bill that is bring fascism back. And so, you know, everyone gets pissed off. Like, three of his cabinet ministers resign. And this also pulls the whole left together, and they form something called the People's Council, and they start a general strike, drop the bill, and Kishi and they win, and Kishi's forced to pull the bill, and it makes him way weaker politically. And when he tries to get his security, like Anpo, the security treaty, ratified by the Diet, those same groups form this even larger group called the People's Council for Preventing Revision to Security Treaty. And this thing is massive. It's got 134 different organizations in it. You know, the biggest of them are the Japanese Socialist Party, the General Council of Trade Unions in Japan, who are a very powerful trade union federation. And then there's Zengokuren, which is the Japanese radical student movement, who we will talk more about in a little bit. Yeah, the Japanese Communist Party is also sort of involved in this, but like, they don't want to let them join for political reasons initially. But, you know, the other thing about this, like, it's not just like leftist orgs. Like, Japan's Professional Association for like thespians is in this coalition. Like, yeah, there's, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, there's a lot of groups that are like not inherently political groups that are in this. And
interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, this is basically, this is the product of like all the stuff the left has been doing for the past, basically since the war like ended. And so, you know, and these guys point out that, you know, so Kishi is able to get the clause out about the U.S. interfering to suppress riots and civil wars, but there's still a clause that says the U.S. is allowed to send troops to deal with, quote, all threats to Japan's peace and security, which, you know, yeah.
Threats to peace and security, like people doing politics we don't agree with.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
This is going to end well. Sure.
So the People's Council starts staging these like enormous protests. And, you know, they go on for a few months. It doesn't really do anything until Zengoku Ren, who is the radical student organization, goes rogue. And the important thing about Zengoku Ren is that, like, so A, they're not directly tied to any of the parties. And B, they are like way more willing to fight the cops than anyone else here. Mm-hmm. And so the People's Council is planning this like massive series of protests. But Zengoku Ren looks at like, you know, this is like their eighth giant protest. And Zengoku Ren goes, okay, well, those did nothing. So this one's not going to do anything either. So they form a plan to storm the Japanese parliament building. And, you know, the People's Council, like, finds out about this plan. And they're like, trying to stop Zengoku Ren from doing it. But Zengoku Ren, like, negotiates with, like, the Tokyo's, like, trade unions. And they're able to just do it anyways. So, you know, 500,000 people across Japan and, like, 80,000 people in Tokyo show up to this protest. And, like, in the middle of the march, Zengoku Ren just, like, charges the police barricades, beats back the police, and, like, forces their way into the Diet and takes control of it. And, you know, they hold it for like a day and they leave. And people do not like this. Like even like the socialists and the Japanese Communist Party like condemn them for it. And, you know, public opinion turns against them. And there's this whole like disaster. And, you know, and Zengoku Ren gets like a lot of shit for this because, you know, like they stormed the Diet building. But, you know, it's worth remembering that like everyone else, like everything else the more moderate faction was doing just like didn't work. And what Zengoku Ren did here was drew an enormous amount of attention to the movement. And this is it. And, you know, that's a vital part of like what happens next. And what happens next is that the Socialist Party does like, I think like the funniest set of political tricks I've ever seen in my life, where, you know, like they have this whole thing they want to do where they're trying to just like, they're trying to delay the vote, because I think if they delay the vote fast enough, like long enough, Kishi will just like get like kicked out of the prime ministership by his own party. And, you know, and this, they're able to drag this on until like 1960. And Kishi, like, you know, Kishi's own party won't let him do a floor vote on the bill because like they're mad at him. And so on April 4th, 1970, he creates the Anpo Special Measures Committee from loyal LDP members, which was called nicknamed the Anpo Kamikaze Squad, which is, you know, this is his attempt to try to figure out like how to like get through all of like get this like treaty through before his support collapses and like the Diet session ends. And like literally the day the session is going to end and he's going to lose his opportunity to force his vote through, he starts doing his plan. And the Socialist Party like knows something's bad is going to happen. So they hire a bunch of like quote unquote secretaries who they hire them and they bring them in the building and they barricade the office of the Speaker of the lower house to keep him from leaving his office, which is something that like I wish like our politicians were like, it's like, man, our politics is like, our parliament's so boring. Like, nobody's barricading the Speaker of the House, like, in their office.
Yeah.
It's very sad. You know, and the Speaker, like, tells them to move, and they don't. And so he calls the police to remove the Socialist Diet members by force. And this is a huge deal. Like, this is the second time ever that the police have ever entered the Diet chamber. And it's the only time before or since they've ever like physically removed Diet members. And so, you know, this whole thing's being like broadcast on live TV. And there's the police just like dragging these like parliament members out of this building, like kicking and screaming. And like, you know, and they catch like the Speaker like fighting his way to the rostrum. And he calls a vote to extend the Diet session like 2 minutes before it's supposed to end. And like, he wins the vote. And there's the camera. The camera is like, It pans and it shows all the LDP like ministers clapping, and then it pans to the other half of the Diet, and in the other half of the Diet, every single person in the opposition is gone. There's none of them are there, and because the opposition is completely gone, Kishi makes this like unexpected snap vote to force a treaty through with no debate, and you know, and because of some like legal bullshit, he's able to figure out a way that like the treaty will still go into effect even without the upper house approving it, as long as they just stay in session, and the Japanese public like. Just, they're unbelievably pissed off. Like, even the pro-treaty people look at, like, the ex-fascist guy, like, removing the opposition party by force and holding a previously unknown snap vote with
right.
No debate.
Yeah.
Yeah. like they watch, like, all of this is just on TV. And it, like, Like, it sets off three general strikes. And, you know, and at this point, the protests basically become an anti-Kishi movement. And, like, everyone in the country, like, including, like, the conservative newspapers are calling for him to resign. Like, the business leaders turn on him to the point where, like, they start funding Zengokuren. Like, they start funding the communist student movement through, like, weird organized crime people because they're, like, Zengokuren's mainstream faction is anti-Kishi. Like... Yeah, that's how, like, wild this, and, you know, and like, the other thing is, like, other, like, ordinary people just, like, start showing up to protests, and so, like, 30 million people, which is, like, a third of the total population, shows up to, like, an anti-Kishi protest between 1959 and 1960.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's, like, it pisses off, and this is the defining event of, like, the sort of, like, the immediate post-war generation. Like, this is the thing they remember. Like, so we'll get to this in a little bit, but Shinzo Abe, who was the longest serving Japanese prime minister, he mm-hmm. came out of office, like, last year. So he's Kishi's grandson, and he talks about,
good,
like,
how,
yeah, he learned politics, like, while he was on Kishi's knee, and Kishi was telling him about what was happening in the streets.
Oh, I bet that was fine.
Yeah, it's not great. And, you know, this part, though, is extremely funny. Like, there's a great story about just, like, this kindergartner, like, on the street who asked the famous political scientist Ishida Takashi, why doesn't Kishi just resign already? Like, he's
good
lost
question.
The kindergartners.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and the other thing that's happening with this is that, so Eisenhower is supposed to show up in Japan on the 19th, so he can be there for the 21st, which is supposed to, he's coming to this giant visit that's, it's supposed to be like the 100th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the US and Japan. And this is also the treaty goes into effect. And so, you know, you on June 4th, there's the largest general strike in Japanese history. And then on the 15th, there's another general strike that has 6.4 million people in it. And at this strike, you know, a bunch of, like, street performers, artists, and writers, like, go to, like, give a petition to Parliament. And they all get attacked by this, like, giant fascist mob with, like, wooden poles with nails in them. And the mob's just chanting,
Jesus.
Like, we will kill you and beat them dead.
Jesus.
And, yeah. And, like, 80 people are injured. And again, like, these are like theater actresses. Yeah.
Classic fascism stuff.
Yep. It's like, yes, we will beat these theater actresses and poets, and this will make us strong.
Yeah, that scans.
Yeah, and so 11 people are injured, and 80 people are injured, and 11 people get hospitalized. And meanwhile, Zengokuren is like, we're gonna storm the Diet again, and you know,
seems like it worked the last time.
Yeah, well, but the funny thing is, this time it does work, and it works because so they fight the cops for a long time, and it's kind of a stalemate, and the cops do this counterattack. But in this counterattack, they trample a Tokyo University undergrad named Kamba Michiko to death.
Oof.
And that causes the crowd to just, like, go wild because, you know, the police just trampled a child to death.
Yeah.
And so 4,000 students storm the Diet, and they hold it until 1 a.m. in these, like, running street battles with the police. And this is where, like everyone turns on Kishi.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the combination of the cops, like, murdered a girl and they beat up a bunch of theater actresses is mm-hmm. just too much. And at this point, it becomes clear that, you know, if Eisenhower comes to Japan, they won't be able to keep him safe.
Right.
Because they can't hold the streets.
Yeah, that could be a little bit of a faux pas for Japan.
Yeah. You know, and Kishi like really wants this to happen because like the Eisenhower visit and the treaty, like this is everything he's been working for since he became prime minister. And so he has this plan to like mobilize the self-defense forces, which is what the Japanese army is called.
Yeah.
Because euphemisms. Yeah, but he has this plan to like mobilize an entire division of like the army and march them through the streets to clear the streets and get Eisenhower in. And even his defense chief and the head of the national police is like, you can't do this. Like there will literally be an uprising. And so Kishi undeterred is like, okay, so I'm going to go to my Yakuza contacts. So he goes to Kodama and he has this plan to get 18,000 like Yakuza hardliners, like 10,000 guys who work for Yakuza, like street vendors, and 10,000 like veterans, right wing cult members to clear the streets. And like he's going to give them like the government's going to give them like trucks and like food and first aid teams and like command posts and $2.3 million and like airplanes and helicopters.
Oh, that couldn't end badly. Sure.
Yeah. Well, and even his cabinet is like, Kishi, you can't do this. Like, you're going to start a civil war.
Again, and a lot of fascists being like, boy, seems like that's too much fascism.
Yeah, yeah. Kishi is like, yeah, Kishi is the fascist that other fascists are like, whoa, hey now, like, this is too much fascism.
But and, you know what's not too much fascism, Chris?
Unless it's a Black Rifle coffee ad, then.
Unless it's another Black Rifle coffee ad or an ExxonMobil ad or one of those weird Christian cult ads we've been kind of getting.
There was a literal ad for the California Highway Patrol.
Yeah, definitely an ad for chips. That's fascism, too. So, I don't know.
There could be fascism,
I've lost the point that I was trying to make here.
We don't endorse the fascist ads, but it's time for ads, and we're sorry if it's something random we didn't select, and it's horrifying.
We do apologize. We live in an engine of pain. Mm-hmm. Here's some ads.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, starting May 6th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good stuff. Well, we had some ads. All right, I want to hear how this all gets resolved now that this guy's been like, what if we twist that fascism dial up to 11? And all of his friends were like, That kind of seems a little bit high because it seems like we've pissed everybody off with all of the violence we've been doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It ends, I'm not going to say well, but, you know, Kishi eventually backs down and is just like, okay, Eisenhower, like, if you come, we can't protect you. And so Eisenhower cancels his visit, and on the day of the treaty supposed to be ratified, 300,000 people show up around the Diet in Tokyo, but, you know, they can't actually stop the treaty from being ratified. And so, you know, because the treaty is being ratified automatically, there's nothing they can do. And so they stand there, and, you know, it's this very sort of grim scene. Everyone's wearing black armbands and, like, black bandanas mm-hmm. to celebrate, you know, to sort of mourn, like, the death of a protester. But, you know, there's nothing they can really do. And, like, the next day, there's this general strike, and there's, like, some more protests the day after. But Kishi has the final document he needs to sign, like, smuggled to him in a candy box so it couldn't be stolen by protesters.
Nice.
Yeah, and so he signs it, and, you know, like, the next month July 15th, Kishi is forced to resign, and the movement just collapses. So, ooh. You know, it's a mixed bag. Like, on the one hand, they got Kishi. This is the only consequence that Kishi is ever going to face in his entire life. That's not quite true. It's one of exactly two consequences he's ever going to face in his entire life, and he survives both of them. And, but, you know, on the other hand, like, this treaty still went through. And, you know, the sort of left that had built up to stop this becomes incredibly demoralized, and they splinter and fragment, and yeah. And Kishi, you know, because this is the end of Kishi's, like, mainstream political career. But, you know, he doesn't go away. He sort of stays around behind the scenes as this, like, it's kind of like this fixer. And, you know, and he does a few more things at the end of the war.
Yeah, he sounds like he's kind of Nixoned a little bit, where he's got some soft influence, but also nobody wants to really be seen in public with the guy.
Yeah. Well, okay, I will say there are a few people who do want to be seen in public with this guy. And the biggest of those is called the Unification Church, which is this, like...
Oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah. This fanatically anti-communist religious
great.
Cult. Yeah, that allegedly kidnaps and brainwashes children.
Allegedly. Definitely.
Yeah, and Kishi, like... So Kishi is the guy responsible for bringing these people, like, into the LDP's base. And, like the head of this party's a guy named Moon. And he, like, so he gets convicted of tax fraud in, like, the 90s or in the 80s and 90s. But, you know, there's a thing in Japan he gets convicted in the US. And there's a thing in Japanese law where, like, if you've been convicted of a crime, you can't enter the country. Now, so this should have stopped Moon from coming to Japan. But, like, the vice president, you know, even in the 90s, like, the Moonies are still, like, so firmly embedded in the LDP that even in the 90s, like the vice president of Japan personally intercedes and allows them to enter the country illegally. And it's great. This is what Kishi's doing in his sort of, like, last
rad
days. Yeah. And, you know, one other thing, one very weird thing happens at the very end of this, which is that the day before he resigns, Kishi's at this, like, dinner gala, and this dude stabs him, like, six times, and then he gives this extremely weird quote that was, it's something like, I stabbed him six times, but if I was trying to kill him, he would be dead. And there's all this, and nobody actually knows why he tried to assassinate Kishi or didn't try to assassinate him, instead just stabbed him six times. There's a lot of theories. Like, the guy was, like, an old fascist from, like, the 30s. He was, like, 60 at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his stated response was that he talked to the family of, like, the girl that had died. But, like, that doesn't make any sense, because, like, this guy's a fascist. And there's another theory that, like, this is a Yakuza hit. Because Bamako Ono, like, was pissed off that Kishi wouldn't help him be prime minister. So he was just like, okay, I'll send a guy to stab you. I don't know. There's a lot of very weird theories about this. But, you know, it's sort of unclear what happens. And, you know, Kishi survives this. And, you know, even though the LDP, like, is now Kishi-less, quote unquote, the structures and political organizations that he put in place are, you know, they're still here to this day. And that brings us to Kishi's grandson, Shinzo Abe, the longest serving prime minister in Japanese history, who finally left office last year because of an ulcer in his rectum, which, you know,
critical support to his rectum ulcer.
Oh, man.
Yep.
Oh, gosh.
Now,
Didn't
no,
he,
Abe.
It's not good when I laugh in unison with Robert.
Sometimes good things happen to good people.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
Now, Abe is a member of a group called Nippon Kagai, which is a fascist group that, according to a U.S. congressional report, believes that, quote, Japan should be applauded for liberating much of East Asia from Western colonial powers, that the 1946 and 1948 Tokyo war crimes tribunals were illegitimate, and that the killings by Japanese troops during the 1937 Nanjing massacre were exaggerated or fabricated. And they also openly call for a restoration of the monarchy and the institution of Shinto as a state religion. And Abe himself has, like, repeatedly stated that Japanese military sex slaves, he used the term comfort women because, you know, the euphemisms help him do denialism, but he,
sure.
You know, he like, has said on multiple occasions that these sex slaves were never forced to be raped.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's okay. Great. Cool dude. Yeah, no, yeah. Bad guy. Sweet.
Yeah, and, you know, and he's also a big champion. He's, like, the champion of, like, so one of Kishi's, like, other signature issue when he was a politician was rearming Japan because he was pissed off that, like, Japan couldn't still be a... Like, and when I say rearming, I don't mean defense force. Like, he wants Japan to
he
be
wants
able to
Japan
declare war
to,
again.
To have an effective military that can invade shit. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He wants him to be an empire again. And yeah. Abe's also, like, a giant rearmament person.
Sure.
And,
ABR,
you know,
baby.
And, yeah, and he also visits something called... There's a shrine called the... Yasukune Shrine, which is this shrine to, like, soldiers who died serving the Japanese emperor. And, you know, the shrine has this thing called the Book of Souls, which, like, has the name of, like, everyone who died, like, serving for the emperor or whatever. There's, like, 2 million people in it. Now, in this book are 1,068 people who were convicted of war crimes and also the 14 Class A war criminals who died or were executed, who are also considered martyrs. And this includes Tojo... And it's yeah, and you know, now for very obvious reasons, China and Korea, and both the Koreas, this is like one of the few things both Koreas like really completely agree on, is that they get absolutely pissed off about prime ministers visiting a shrine to the people who enslaved, raped, and murdered tens of billions of their people. But you know, Abe did it anyways, because modern Japan is Kishi's Japan. Despite the protests, despite the strikes, despite a third of the country taking to the streets, he won. The only thing he didn't get was rearmament, and so, you know, the mass rapes in Korea and Vietnam will be left to the Americans, not the Japanese. But we all now live in the world that Kishi created.
Cool.
Yeah. All right, Robert.
What a happy
promised,
story you told us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I promised at the beginning of this episode that at the end of the episodes I would ask you, is this the worst rehabilitation of a fascist war criminal?
In terms of, like, the actual amount of power he got? Probably, yeah. I think probably, because yeah, you've got like guys like Von Braun, but like Von Braun was bad, and it's fucked up that he got rehabilitated. But the thing he went on to do wasn't bad. It was helping to put a man on the moon, which is like fine. And you've got, I don't know, there was that Nazi general who the CIA used to set up a spy ring, and he did some fucked up stuff, but I think certainly had less geopolitical influence than this guy. Yeah, I think this is definitely, I'm racking my brain, but I'm not coming up with one to top it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah.
Should have started this episode with what's rehabilitating my fascists.
That would have been better.
That would have been a probe.
Mm-hmm. And it turns out the what is my government.
Yeah.
You love to see it. You love to see it. Well, Chris.
Is that the entire thing?
Yeah.
What are you, Chris?
I don't feel good about that, to be honest. Not a good tale.
What do you think Nicolas Cage's hair smells like?
Nicolas Cage's hair?
Yeah, what do you think his hair smells like? I've been looking at a picture of him for the last 3 hours.
That explains so much. Chris, I have a guess.
I don't think it smells very good, because, like, you know, isn't Nicolas Cage like constantly isn't he constantly like doing bad movies because he needs money for his, like, isn't it like an elephant habit? He's like some weird
he's addicted to buying dinosaur skulls.
That's what it is.
Okay, I think his hair smells like nail polish remover with a hint of poop.
See, I was gonna say fake apples, but like the specific fake apple smell that they put in like agricultural products, like medicine for horses, like ivermectin fake apples.
That's fair. Hint of poop.
I don't know. We'll see. If you've smelled Nicolas Cage, hit us up on social media. Let us know. Tell us who's right. One of us has to be.
I think you might be right, though. I think it might smell like that really bad apple flavored like alcohol. Also.
Yeah, a little bit of that. A little bit of that.
A hint of poop.
All right. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Someone out there has smelled Nicolas Cage's hair, and they'll let us know who's right.
Let us know. That's really what we're
That way, we're not just
Robert,
we're
why
not
have
just
you been staring at a photo of Nicolas Cage for 3 hours. Let's get back to that.
Because it's been a long day, Sophie. Everybody needs something to perk them up.
6 hours before
the halfway
you did.
Point. Look, at the midway point of the day, some people have another cup of coffee. Some people stare wordlessly at a photograph of Nicolas Cage while their friend talks about war crimes for 3 hours.
Chris, where can people follow you?
You can follow me being extremely depressed about this at itmechr3 on Twitter. Yeah. If you want to read a slightly less depressing thing that I wrote, I wrote a piece for Lausanne that's like about Tiananmen, which I swear is less depressing than this, if only sort of marginally. I work for Cool Zone now, so I'm on.
Yeah, expect
I'm
a lot
on,
of Chris
a lot of other
face.
Things.
Yeah.
Yep. You can't get rid of me now.
Nope.
So have a good day, and remember, tell us what Nicolas Cage's hair smells like.
Yep.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.